also joined by Rodan Public Radio political analyst Scott McKay. Hello, Scott.
Good morning, everyone.
Congressman Cicilline, you're a liberal Democrat. We understand you're upset about Donald Trump's emergence as the new president. But what's your explanation for why Democrats lost so much ground in governor seats, in state legislatures, and in other offices during Barack Obama's two terms as president?
You know, I think it's a combination of things. We didn't have a good economic message in our presidential campaign. One of the things I'm really excited about is in this new position as the Democratic Policy and Communications Co-Chair, we're going to really focus on what is our, not only our set of priorities for the next 2 years, but what's the effective message to really speak to the American people. And I think we didn't talk enough about people, particularly in the Midwest, who have seen their jobs go overseas, who didn't see our candidate talk enough about addressing the struggles, the fact that it's, you know, people can't afford to get by, people can't afford their health insurance, they can't afford to send their kids to school. It's just they're working harder, they're not making enough money, and they didn't have any sense that there was an economic plan. What Donald Trump said is, I'm bringing your jobs back. Now, it didn't sound like a realistic answer to most folks, but you know what? For a desperate person who was hoping for to hear something, it at least acknowledged those folks existed and that he was sort of going to had a plan for them. And I think that was part of our failure.
Beyond refining the message, what are the other lessons for Democrats from the 2016 election?
I think, you know, the American people want to know what the Democrats really stand for, and they want to have confidence that they're really willing to fight for those things. And, you know, whether it's in the area of climate change, whether it's in rebuilding American manufacturing, whether it's protecting our democracy by campaign finance reform, and they have to have confidence that we're actually fighting for them about things that matter in their lives. And most of that is an economic message. How are we going to create good paying jobs and get people back to work?
Let's go to Scott.
You know, some more traditional Democrats think that the Democratic Party has become too much of a faculty lounge and not enough of a union hall. And they think that a lot of leading Democrats are pushing issues like transgender rights, that this means that they're not addressing the underlying economic problems that a lot of workers face.
No, you know, look, I think the Democratic Party has a very proud tradition on issues of equality and inclusion and civil and human rights that we should always be proud of. But the reality is, in addition to that, we should be talking about things that matter to people in the heartland, in the Midwest, who are very concerned about the economic future of their families. And so, you know, my experience is people will give you a pass even if they disagree with you on a bunch of those issues. If they have a good job, if they feel confident about the future, if they can take care of their family. And so we have to really focus on an economic message that demonstrates to people what we are, which is the party for working people, trying to raise people's wages, create more economic opportunity. And I don't think they heard enough of that from us. And maybe it's because of the influence of certain segments of our party, but I think we just didn't have an economic message. And in fairness, our presidential candidate sort of sets that tone. It's hard to have a separate narrative from the Democratic presidential candidate.
We've heard a lot about Russia and hacking in the last few months. Do you believe that Donald Trump won the election due to Russian influence?
Well, I'll tell you this. I believe without any question that the Russian government led by Vladimir Putin interfered with our elections in a very sophisticated cyber counterintelligence operation, both hacking into the DNC and then releasing those materials through WikiLeaks, creating fake news on the internet, and really with a clear intention to undermine the election of Hillary Clinton and elect Donald Trump as president. There's no question about it. That's the conclusion of the intelligence agencies, and I've attended a classified briefing and read the materials to support that. And the question, of course, is what impact did that have on the election? I don't think anyone knows that for sure, but we know it was intended to influence the outcome, and it was a very close election. He won the Electoral College, but she won the popular vote by almost 3 million votes. So no one will ever know. He's our president. He's won fair and square, I guess. But we should be very concerned about this. This should be an effort by Republicans and Democrats to come together, get to the bottom of this, and protect our democracy from this kind of interference.
How did you feel about the U.S. Stance vis-a-vis Israel in the U.N.?
I didn't support the U.S. position. I thought the resolution was incredibly one-sided. I think, you know, I've been clear, I think the settlements are an impediment to peace. Our policy has always recognized that. We should continue to press hard for that, the settlements not to continue. But that resolution didn't really acknowledge in any meaningful way the malicious activities of the Palestinians, and it was very one-sided, particularly coming out of the UN, which has a long history of being anti-Israel in many ways, and so I think we should have vetoed it. I was disappointed that we didn't.
We're talking here with Congressman David Cicilline, and to come back to Rhode Island for a little bit, you're obviously a former mayor of Providence. Do you think the city should look at the possibility of bankruptcy, and was it a mistake for Mayor Jorge Lorza to rule that out?
I think it's a very has very negative consequences for cities, and I think the mayor has made it clear that he's able to move the city forward without that, and I think that's a good thing. I think, you know, challenges always exist, never having enough money for all the things you need to do in difficult times. I think the mayor has made some hard decisions, and I think if his conclusion is that that option is not necessary, we should accept that, and it wouldn't be good for the city in the long term.
The preliminary U.S. Census results show that we're probably only going to have one U.S. House seat after the 2020 count. And I'm wondering, do you foresee yourself still being in Congress then?
It's a long time away. I mean, that won't happen until 2022.
That's
I hope
correct.
We don't lose a seat, not because I'm worried about a job, but because it's not good for Rhode Island. It's sort of a kick in our stomach. Maybe the governor's proposal on education is going to bring lots of new residents to our state, and so that won't happen. But
isn't it protesting a little too much when you and your colleague, Congressman Langevin, talk about how far in the future this is? Can you see squaring off against Congressman Langevin in a competition if we're down to one seat?
You know, we're about to take on probably the most perilous administration in my lifetime, and we are faced with protecting the Affordable Care Act, protecting education funding, protecting women's right to choose, preventing the Supreme Court from swinging further to the right. We've got a lot of stuff on our plate, and we're really focused on that. There's going to be a lot of time to figure out what happens 5 or 10 years from now.
You're a big supporter of Governor Raimondo. Sometimes her approval ratings are not always the best, although there's supposedly some other polling out there that shows her approval rating increasing. If her approval ratings have been not that robust, what's your explanation for that?
Look, I think the governor has taken on a lot of difficult issues. I've been incredibly impressed with not only her work, but her team and the kind of changes they're making. Some of that's not visible right away. But I think she's done a terrific job in terms of bringing new investment and new businesses to our state. She's done a lot of work to kind of restructure departments that you don't necessarily see, but that are producing better outcomes. And this is, you know, it's hard work. This is a difficult, we're still in a really difficult economy, although we're finally coming out of the recession. I think she's working hard. She's assembled a great team, and she's producing real results for our state.
I'm wondering, you were mayor of Providence, and you understand the problems that nonprofits pose for the city. Are they doing enough to help the city, the people like Brown, Rhode Island Hospital, Providence College, all these glorious institutions, but they don't pay taxes?
Yeah. I mean, they make payments now, as you know, that I began and that Mayor Tavares continued, and Mayor Lorza, obviously, I think, has even added to that, their payments in lieu of taxes. They obviously make tremendous other contributions in terms of the vibrancy and the economy of the city.
I know,
jobs.
But they don't pay the firefighters.
Yeah, I mean, part of the problem is, one of the things we propose, which I think is really a good answer, is I proposed a piece of legislation which was called the Shared Prosperity Act that said if a nonprofit grows, that the income taxes that are generated from that new entity are split between the city and the state evenly until the city gets what they would have gotten had they paid property taxes, so that the city can benefit from the economic growth of college universities, but that principally goes to sales and income tax, which goes to the state. So I think that would be an answer to say, make sure so that we can be excited about their growth, that half of it comes to the municipality. I think that would be a huge improvement. And you know, it's a challenge because they provide tremendous benefits to cities, but obviously they don't contribute to taxes the way the taxpayers do, and it's a challenge.
We're out of time, so we have to leave it there. Thanks for joining us, Scott.
Great to be here.
And Rhode Island's 1st District Congressman David Cicilline.
Thank you for having me.